everyone. Happy Tuesday. You're listening to Focus on Business, and I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's show, we are talking with nonprofit attorney Ed Chaney of Shell Bray, PLLC. Based here in the Chapel Hill, Carrboro area, and from the living in this area, Ed focuses his practice on advising tax-exempt organizations on a broad range of tax and corporate matters. Ed has extensive experience in those philanthropic organizations that and on operational and tax compliance matters, including donor-advised fund operations and private foundation grant-making and program-related investments. He also advises on the tax requirements for supporting those nonprofit tax-exempt organizations, the structuring of substantial charitable gifts, and the management of endowment funds. Ed has also spent a significant time assisting in community economic development and affordable housing organizations with their governance and tax compliance needs. His clients include both operating charities and philanthropic organizations. Prior to attending law school, Mr. Chaney worked for 10 years in the nonprofit sector, serving as a program director, an executive director, a board member, and board chair with a number of tax-exempt organizations. So I was saying Ed lives here in the Carrboro Chapel Hill area with his wife Mandy Hitchcock and their children, and he enjoys being outside. We were just talking about running and biking, cooking meals, and reading. The firm he's with, Shell Bray PLLC, was founded in 1987 in Greensboro, North Carolina, and focuses on the areas of business law and related fields with a commitment to rendering legal services of the highest quality on a timely basis. Ed, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
We want to talk today about something that people have probably heard of, but probably might not actually know exactly what it means. What are philanthropic organizations? How do they operate, and what is philanthropy in this day and age?
Well, why don't we start there to back up and sort of give a high level of what the role of philanthropy is in our society and why it's so important and why everybody should give, and then we can talk about the ways in which you can do that.
Sounds great.
Okay. I guess the most important thing is that philanthropy has always been an incredibly important and integral part of our democracy and even our economy. The way I think about it, there are really four ways in which philanthropy impacts us significantly on a daily basis.
What are those ways?
The first is that philanthropy steps in where the free market fails.
So where for-profits can't meet the need because it's not profitable or some other mechanism is not appropriate for doing that, philanthropic organizations step in.
Exactly right. Not everything could be monetized in such a way that, value can be exchanged for, or money can be exchanged for the value that's being provided. I mean, think homeless services.
Right. Some people that need the service do not have the cash to do the transaction or the time or whatever to do it.
Right. It doesn't make sense for the private sector to provide homeless services, but yet we as a society value that very highly. So that is a place where philanthropy can step in and play a role. Similarly, philanthropy, this goes to the second point, philanthropy steps in when the government fails.
Because the government is not the answer for providing the gaps. I'm going to say it. It's on election day, too. So the government has a role, but it's not always there to meet the social needs of the private sector.
Right. I mean, I think, nothing is perfect. Government is not perfect. Capitalism is not perfect. And you need multiple legs to hold a stool standing, and the stool being our society.
Government, just like corporations, for-profit entities, are human. They're human inventions. They're run by humans. And so those flaws that we have as humans carry into those organizations.
Sure, sure. And they're, of course, driven by the trends of the day.
Various motives.
Exactly.
Right.
So, I think a great example of where philanthropy steps in, where government fails, is that it is historically a traditional function of government to educate our youth.
Right.
When you sort of look broadly, we've done a pretty good job at that. But we have also failed. The government has really failed in some pretty dramatic ways.
Well, and it's like you think someone graduates high school, they can read, they can write, they can do math to the level that they need to live. And that's no longer true.
Right. Yeah. And you look at socio and economic factors that play into this, and you see, you know, vast achievement gaps, and you see dramatic differences in educational outcomes between a school in an urban concentration where there's a high number of low-income kids who are, you know, getting free and reduced lunch versus a wealthier suburban school is sort of the typical examples.
Well, and I think of that in Andre Agassi, one of the six most successful tennis players of our time. He started a school out in Las Vegas where he was for the inner city kids, and it's made such a huge difference. And so that's where philanthropy really stepped into the educational role and made a difference.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, there are a number of examples of charter schools or turnaround schools that are driven by philanthropic leaders and dollars. Of course, there are also governmental dollars in there as well. But there are also a number of educational reform and policy organizations that are driven by philanthropy that, you know, take a look at structural issues and how to overcome those issues. So, you know, I think it's just a great example of how philanthropy can both partner with and also supplement government functions when those
supplement
are,
or supplant.
yes.
Okay.
the third major way that philanthropy impacts our society is that it enables us. It either directly expresses or it enables the expression of ideas and voices, and that can come down in terms of arts and cultural. It can come down in terms of socio-political and things like this wonderful radio station that
right.
we have here.
We are community supported, and we're having a fundraiser this Thursday.
So show your philanthropy and please give.
Yes.
And also religious. The whole most religious organizations are philanthropic organizations as well. So you know, the philanthropy allows those things to be expressed in our society, and it gives us the liberty to express those in a more organized way.
Well, and a philanthropic organization foundation usually comes out of people who are highly successful. One of the most prominent ones now, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Those come out of for-profit activities, and they want to give back. They want to do something with those profits, with those returns that they've benefited from, and now they want to change things through those fundings.
Absolutely. That is typically where you've seen the biggest players in philanthropy generate from historically, from really successful business ventures, be it the railroads, the tobacco industry,
automotive, the Ford Foundation,
exactly.
Rockefeller's Foundation.
Right? Yeah, we're sort of now in the world where the high tech folks are creating their philanthropic organizations. But we are in the midst of a giant transfer of wealth and between generations, between mm-hmm. the boomers and anybody that's sort of beneath the boomers.
After the boomers.
The post-boomers. You know, my generation, Generation X, and the millennials. And Generation Y and the millennials, there's going to be a transfer of wealth that is also going to spur a lot of philanthropy that isn't necessarily, it's not going to necessarily get its genesis from building wealth from having a job, but from inheriting it or some
well,
sort of
and we see these highly successful people. John Huntsman comes to mind, where he's a multi-billionaire, and he's pretty much told his kids and his grandchildren, well, You've had this advantage. I'm giving everything away. And he's given away 80% of his wealth mm-hmm. into cancer research and mm-hmm. the Huntsman Hospital. So when you were looking at that, that transfer of wealth is in a different way than just generational inheritance anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you're seeing, particularly with high wealth individuals, the challenge that Bill and Melinda Gates laid down for everybody to give away their wealth or to give away a substantial amount of wealth. And, you know, I saw some high name folks come on board with that, Warren Buffett included. But that's something that pre-existed, Bill and Melinda Gates. They've been a great advocate.
But they're sort
in
of
lifting
just the poster child.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, for that to make that more. But, in our consciousness.
But that is a beautiful aspect, I think, of American culture. And there has always been an element of that here where...
Well, and I think the United States has led that around the world. We've come to expect if there's a national disaster, if there's something going on in the world, the United States is usually charitably giving as a government and as a people more than any other country in the world.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think that all goes back to underscoring how valuable philanthropy is to creating our own culture and creating our democracy, and how we act internally and how we act externally. I think a great mantra that I try to live by is how you do anything is how you do everything. If you build in giving into your right. daily life, it becomes a part of you. I really think it's become a part of America in many, many important ways.
Well, and it's in our Judeo-Christian background, tithing to the church, giving to the poor, helping the widows and the children. I mean, it's kind of integrated into the culture that built this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And so we're harvesting that now. We've got seeds. We've had success in this country. And different things also motivate it, like tax reform or lack of tax reform, so people can give to charities to help pass something on that would not be there if it's taxed by death taxes and things like that.
Absolutely. I will say there are, philanthropy exists in many other cultures, in all cultures,
yes.
And it's expressed in many ways, and it's found in every major religion or philosophy. It sort of manifests, I think, its purpose here in the United States a bit differently than it has elsewhere. You find the joys of giving across cultures.
Well, and it's not just giving your money. It's giving time. It's giving resources. It's giving expertise. All kinds of ways of giving.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, because when we talk about philanthropy, everybody sort of defaults to Bill and Melinda Gates
right.
and the Ford
and
Foundation.
And I'm not big enough to do that.
Exactly.
So
right.
I'm not doing anything.
Exactly right. That to me is one of the most important things that I like to communicate, is that philanthropy is accessible to everybody, and it's important for everybody to participate. It's not just for the big donors. It's for small donors. It's for people who don't even have the financial resources to give, but can give talent or time if they don't have the treasure to give. And you from time to time you hear these amazing stories of people who, with very, very little sort of cash flow resources on their day-to-day basis, somehow saving up to make a magnificent gift that has an incredible impact.
What comes to mind is a woman in Michigan that sent 19 kids to college,
yeah.
and she was, I believe, a cleaning lady.
Yes.
If I recall that one correctly.
Yes, yes. And there's a similar story in Mississippi, where it was a washerwoman who saved her money. She didn't have a car. She didn't need a car. She saved her money and endowed a scholarship at Southern Mississippi University. So
we can do great things with a little.
Yes, absolutely.
Our time, and when I started my business, I volunteered a lot with one of the entrepreneurial groups as a nonprofit. Didn't have a lot of money to put in sponsoring things at that point, but I had time, and it was also a great way for me to connect to that community when I was getting a foundation for the business.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there are also now a bunch of new programs that, they call them deputized fundraiser programs, where, you can sign up to do an event and raise money for a cause that you feel really strongly about, such as cancer research with the Lymphoma and Leukemia Society, or various MS bike
how
rides.
Do, how do
and
those work?
Like that. Well, you sign up and to do like a race or an event or something like that, and commit to raise a certain amount of money, and
so you're going around and asking your friends to sponsor you on a ride or a walk or things
exactly,
like that.
Or doing creative things like bake sales on the weekend or whatever, and scraping together $1,000, and it may not seem a lot, but when you put all of these people together raising $1,000, all of a sudden you've got substantial money going towards a very important cause.
And building awareness through those efforts.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So when we're thinking of a philanthropic organization, how do we interact with them as a nonprofit? How do we interact to them as someone else that's in a charitable giving mode? What's those roles, and how do they interact with the community and potential recipients?
Yeah. I think there are a number of ways to give, and there are a number of resources out there. So it kind of depends on where you are as a giver, how much activity you want to, or how much involvement you want with the organizations, or whether you prefer to sort of be more passive or anonymous even. And, you know, based on various factors, there's a whole range of options for you.
Let's talk about some of those factors. What kind of factors come into play in making those decisions?
I think a key one is your level of engagement and awareness of what you want to give and
okay, so how much
opportunities. Sure.
And what type of organization. So if it's a cancer fund of some sort or ALS or whatever. So whatever is near and dear to your heart first and foremost.
Sure, sure. And, you know, you may already have sort of, well, I want to give to X, Y, or Z organizations and I know what I want and I know what my giving budget is. And, you know, you can sort of, if you've got all that lined up, you know, nothing's stopping you from cutting checks directly and volunteering directly with those organizations.
But if I don't, let's say I'm just out of college, I've got my first real job, I want to identify some organizations. How do I know which ones are worth getting involved with? How do I know they're going to use my money wisely? How do I assess those?
That is a really good question. And frankly, there isn't a clear
There isn't a single answer
for that or a single source. That's exactly right.
I go to the IRS and I check out their standing. Are they still a nonprofit? Are they still in good standing? And then I go other places and start looking.
Right. I mean, nothing substitutes direct involvement with the organization.
Right.
I mean, if you really want to get to know an organization, the best way to do so is to go volunteer with them and spend some time with them and get to know how they operate and what their impact is. There are organizations out there that will evaluate nonprofits, and there's a lot of debate about the efficacy of that evaluation and sort of what the measures are that they're looking at.
Yeah, because a lot of time you go to those and they say, well, 12% goes to admin or 36% goes to admin and that kind of stuff, and then you really have to dig into that number to know what that means.
Right, right. And giving to admin, you know, sometimes it's a good thing. I mean, you know, there are times
they don't exist without admin.
Exactly right. I mean, there are some times that an organization absolutely needs to invest in its infrastructure and build itself up so it can
boards,
take the next step.
Training, software. We've talked about it on the show before about accounting.
Yep.
You can't manage well if you don't know what you're managing. And so if you're not doing your accounting well, there's all these things that put the mission at risk. So some portion needs to be going to administrative. And it needs to be invested in to make sure things are going well.
That's right. That's right. The other thing so that's hard to measure, sort of what, you know, when you look at somebody's financial records, which you can find on GuideStar.com or GuideStar.org, rather. You can
GuideStar.org?
Yes. You can look at any organization. Any 501c3 charity has to file a Form 990 in one form or another.
It's essentially their equivalent of an annual tax return without the taxes.
Exactly. It's called an information return. And if they have revenue above a certain threshold, they file a more detailed form that is a public record. And the IRS turns those over to an organization called GuideStar, and GuideStar posts them on a searchable database online. So you can go in and type in your favorite organization like Leukemia and Lymphoma Society and click search and it'll pop
up. WCOM.
Or WCOM. And you can read that organization's financial information if they've, you know, if they're required to file that particular form. And when you look at that, it's hard to really sort of look at that and know. I mean, it'll give you a high level of how much money they're bringing
right.
in and where they're spending it. But, you know, again, nothing is a substitute for getting to know the organization. The other sort of measure that you have to think about isn't just sort of how they are financially, how they're spending their money. Are they healthy? Is what kind of impact they're having? And
right. Are they really executing that mission?
Right. And that is that's not easy to do. I mean, if you're a homeless services organization,
mm-hmm.
you know, what measures are you using there? I mean, are you using how many meals you are serving on a daily basis, or are you measuring the extent to which folks come in the door, get transitioned into you know, transitional housing or a job or something to take them off the streets?
So again, it gets back to what we think are key performance indicators when we're giving our money to different organizations.
Right.
So if it's education, are they graduating students that can read and write and be prepared to go to college or trade or those kind of things? So it's things that relate to that specific charity's mission.
That's right. And those things, I think, can be challenging to measure, and you can look at them through different lenses. So I just caution folks, if you're looking at a third party that's purports to and may be doing a good job of evaluating programmatic outcomes, it's important to know what kind of lens that they are using to analyze.
Yeah, what's their metric? Let's say if they're giving up 1 to 5 stars, what does each of those levels equate to? What did they look at to award those type of scores?
That's exactly right. So, you know, there are the resources here and in any local community, too, that can help you get involved with the local communities.
Give us a few examples.
In the Triangle, we've got the Triangle Community Foundation, which is a place where donors can become engaged both financially and on a volunteer basis with the various nonprofits in our local community here. You can support individual organizations through Triangle Community Foundation, or you can support what are called field of interest funds, where they've got a fund for the arts, and you can make a contribution to the fund for the arts, and Triangle Community Foundation will make arts-based grants.
So you can specify where your money goes to, mm-hmm. or you can just leave it in the general fund.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right. It can be unrestricted and allow Triangle Community Foundation to make that.
What do you mean by unrestricted? That's a good point to jump into here.
When you make a contribution, you can restrict it for a particular purpose or a particular organization, or you can make an unrestricted gift, which is the most flexible kind of gift that you can make. And you're basically saying, here, organization X, here's $100, spend it as you see fit in the best manner that you see. Or you could say a restricted gift would say, here, literacy organization X, I want to support the specific child literacy program. Mm-hmm. And the organization is obligated to use your donation to support
that. Sometimes you see that on the cards
program.
Do you want to designate your gift?
Right, exactly.
And
right.
So let's use a church again. You go in, you tithe, you put it in, and they might say, do you want it to go to the building fund or the teenage or the missions or what does, and we're designating where those dollars go.
Exactly.
And then that makes it restricted or unrestricted from the accounting side of doing everything.
Yes, and importantly, it also it creates a legal obligation on behalf of the organization when you make a restriction. That's the organization.
And what do you mean by legal? Is it a contractual type of thing? They have to use it, or is it even more than that?
It's a little bit more than that. I mean, it kind of gets into this hazy trust law, but you are, in effect, entrusting the organization to spend the money as you designated, and that obligates the organization. It creates a fiduciary obligation to get a sort of legal technical term here to spend the money as you have designated. And if they don't, it's a violation of that fiduciary obligation.
What are those ramifications, and how would you ever know?
Another good question.
I'm full of them today, Ed.
Excellent. Good. So historically, the person who is in charge with enforcing the restrictions of a gift has been the Attorney General of the state in which you live.
So in our state, North Carolina.
Right. So it would be the North Carolina Attorney General. Right. And that's, you know, because these assets are not seen as individually owned or held. They're seen
they're
as
public.
Assets for the public, right? And so the Attorney General wears the hat of protecting the public. And so historically, it's been the case that the Attorney General has been charged. So if there's ever been a dispute, if a donor learns, for instance, you know, I gave $100,000 to X organization for this project, and they ended up
not doing the project.
Yeah,
that's kind of obvious.
or spending it for another purpose, or diverting it altogether to a non-charitable purpose. Then you would go to the Attorney General, and the Attorney General would sort of weigh the facts and figure out if they, you know, had enough to pursue a case.
Now, are there mandatory audit requirements for 501c3s?
They're only with respect to, well, some state laws. Let me back up. So the general answer is no. There isn't sort of inherently anything in tax code, in the 501c3 tax code, or in sort of the general nonprofit corporation acts that are adopted by the states. However, there are some states that have – almost all states have adopted some sort of charitable solicitation licensing regime, which means that if you're a nonprofit and you're out there soliciting funds from the general public, you have to register with the Attorney General and say, we're doing this. And it's not an onerous application process, but it is a little bit of work. And some states require additional reporting, and some states even require audited financial statements if you raise above certain thresholds.
Well, and if you take government funds directly through a grant or through a flow through of your subgrantee, there are usually audit requirements that come along with those funds.
That's the other example, yeah.
I'm on that end a lot.
Yeah, I bet you are. I bet you are. Federal grants, and the threshold is increasing. I think it's going up to 750. I think if you've received 750 in 700,
it was 500. It was 350. Yeah. Then it was 500, and now it's 750.
Yeah. So if you receive more than that in federal funds in a year, then you are required to get what's called a circular A-122 audit.
122 is the reg for that. You're close, because that's the regulation. So. And it's kind of an interesting thing to watch organizations evolve as they get different type of funding, because I think there's a reluctance to invest in the audits unless they're mandatory. Mm-hmm. But then it's also a good thing because it lets you see what's going on, how effective you're being, and it keeps an eye on how everyone's doing in the business, how your financial control is doing. Are you recording everything? It gives potential donors a better comfort level to know someone third party is looking at your numbers.
Absolutely, and I think you've hit on something. There's what's required, and then there's what's best practice.
Right,
and it is certainly a best practice to get audited financial statements, particularly if you are a sophisticated organization that is bringing in significant amounts of money on an annual basis.
Yeah, I always make the recommendation to plan as you get larger to include that audit in there, because the other thing is we don't always see in nonprofits that there's a lot of training going on, or a qualified financial person is doing the bookkeeping or the accounting, the day-to-day type of controllership roles, cash management, and those kind of things. So if you don't have someone inside bringing in that third party again to take a look at things, can give you a different set of eyes as to how you do it better and make sure that you're meeting all those contractual requirements, essentially, of receiving designated or restricted funds, and you're meeting those.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not funny, but it often is the case that legal issues come my way because an auditor has uncovered something.
Yeah.
So,
or somebody like me that comes in before the auditor and says, "Okay, we got to clean this up."
Right. Yeah. Some sort of third-party financial. You know, so I have a soft place in my heart for accountant and financial professionals.
Those who generate billable hours.
But no, seriously. I mean, I think the more important aspect here is that there are legal issues that nonprofits aren't necessarily aware of.
And it's better to build it in, to be aware of it, to be doing those things with robust systems than it is to try to deal with the legal issue afterward, because it is much more expensive.
Exactly right.
After you've done it, some things can't be cleaned up, and that puts your whole mission at risk.
Absolutely.
Now, another thing I know, and our listeners may not know, is that if a nonprofit goes away and ceases to exist, its assets and its funds have to go somewhere.
Correct.
It can't be distributed to the people running it. It has to go to another nonprofit. How does that occur? And what kind of things do they have to think of about when doing that?
So a fundamental requirement to be a 501c3 is that your articles of incorporation, the instrument that you drafted to create yourself as
how you're going to run the business, how you're going to run it,
had to include a provision that says if you're dissolved, then your assets are going to be distributed for one or more charitable purposes or to one or more organizations described in Section 501c3. Typically what happens, oftentimes, frankly, there aren't a whole lot of assets at the end. If an organization is going under, it's often because it's no longer financially viable. But if an organization is in a situation where it, for whatever reason, decides to make a decision to dissolve with
assets, we can happily say, well, in our example here, we'll say they fulfilled their mission and now they can move on.
Yes, they have saved the world. It is time to it's time to move on.
There are no homeless, there are no poor, there are no cancer patients left.
Most articles of incorporation leave that up to the board to make a decision, the board of directors of the organization. So their board of organization will need to identify another organization with same or similar charitable purposes and vote to make a distribution when they dissolve. The many states require that dissolution be approved by the Attorney General.
Okay. To make sure restricted funds.
Exactly.
All those kind of things can get handled appropriately.
Exactly. So restricted funds, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, you can have two types of restricted funds. You can have purpose restricted funds and you can have investment restricted funds. And purpose restricted funds were the ones that we were talking about
right.
earlier.
And so tell us about investment restricted.
Investment restricted funds are also known as endowments. Those are funds that you have to hold the principal of the gift for either a period of years or in perpetuity.
So if someone gives you $5 million, you don't get to spend that $5 million. You get to spend the interest and earnings from that, how that $5 million is invested for 10 years, 20 years, as long as you exist.
Exactly right. You can sort of spend whatever amount you deem to be prudent on an annual basis. And typically these days that's somewhere between 4.5% and 5%. So, if you had, $5 million, you're talking what, $25,000. Is that
roughly,
is that the right number? So just like the purpose restrictions,
right.
when you make an investment restriction, it is enforceable by law. And so if an organization that's dissolving has a $5 million endowment, for instance, you need to figure out where that endowment is going to go. And, sometimes you can go to court and seek a release for that restriction. So
right.
the court will say, yes, the endowment purpose has been fulfilled. You no longer need to hold this in perpetuity and you can distribute it for X, Y, or Z. Or they might say the endowment purpose is still valid and, it can be transferred to this organization.
Now, can nonprofit 501c3 status be transferred? So you start a 501c3, you no longer want to run it or manage it. It's a 3 or 4 person 501c3. Somebody else comes along and wants to take your 501c3 status and run with it. Does it have to be in the same area in which it was awarded? Does it just get transferred? And how does it transfer you can transfer it?
That's a really good question. And I have come across some really interesting examples of things gone wrong.
I get the call quite frequently. It's like, I don't want to do this anymore. So somebody wants to take it over. I said, talk to the state, talk to the IRS, and then go from there.
Yeah, that's right. So a 501c3 organization is not an asset. It's not a personal asset. It is a thing.
You
exists.
Can't sell it.
Right. It is a thing. It exists. And when you apply for tax exemption under 501c3, you tell the IRS what your charitable purposes are and how that furthers exemption under 501c3. And the IRS will grant you exemption or recognize your exemption on the basis of those representations. Going forward, if you change your purposes dramatically, you may no regulations state that you may no longer be able to rely on that determination
right.
letter. So regardless of whether there's sort of a change in control of the organization, if the organization decides to take a sharp right turn and say it was a charter school one day and now it's going to be an affordable housing organization the next, you've got a big issue there, and potentially you can no longer rely on your tax-exempt status just for the purposes of the organization's own tax exemption.
Well, and the one that for me that comes to mind is someone comes in, let's say we start a family violence center type thing, and the person runs it for a little while, doesn't have the traction raising the funds, so it's either going to dissolve, someone else wants to step in. They can change the board, they can change the executive directors, they can change who operates it, but it's still the same mission, and you just have to notify some people that things are getting handed off.
Sure. So you just want to make sure that if there is a change in control, say you've got a founder who was really driven and created this domestic violence organization, built a board that was really sort of centered around that founder's drive and vision, and it was working well as an organization. But burnout happens. Executive director says, "Look, guys, I'm just
or retirement.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
70. I want to retire. Yep,
it's time for me to move on." Maybe the board too says, "Look, yeah, we've been with you all this time, and it's time to change control." Provided that the organization moves forward following its bylaws in terms of who it elects as the directors.
Incorporation
exactly.
document.
Yeah. When a nonprofit forms, you file an articles of incorporation, and then you also adopt bylaws. And your articles of incorporation, it's kind of like your birth certificate. It says, you know, this is me and this is who I am.
And this is my address. This is who's responsible. This is who you contact. This is who's fiduciary. These are my board. All that kind of
right. It can include the initial board, or it can say, you know, the bylaws will or tell you who the initial board will be. Your bylaws are kind of like your operating manual. This is me, my instruction manual. This is how I'm going to operate. This is how the board of directors gets elected, and this is how they select officers. The board of directors is the organization, is the body that governs the organization on a daily basis. It's the one that sets policy, make sure that the organization is achieving its charitable mission. It's the one that hires the executive director.
If there's an audit, it's the one that oversees the audit and gets the audit report.
Yep, exactly. That's exactly right. And it plays a very, very important role. And so in any sort of transition time, they really need to step up to the plate and make sure that they are carefully looking at the best interests of the ongoing organization.
The not-for-profit corporation.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the board a little bit more, because I think that's somewhere a lot of legal issues are arising more and more because of those. Are the board members qualified? Are the board members related?
Mm-hmm.
Are they truly independent? Those types of things. I see this more so on the smaller nonprofits or the early ones getting started. They bring in their father-in-law, their cousin, you know, the board's all family members. And that creates an issue because there's no one independent. There's a different dynamic there. And there's generally a different perception of a board that's all related when someone's coming in and look to give a donation.
Yes, absolutely.
So how do we select the best board even from an early stage? And what do we need that board? Let's say we're going to pick three people to be on a board to start. What people do we need on there? What's our best strategy for selecting a board that's qualified and will give a nice brand or reputation to our organization?
Mm-hmm. That's a really, really good question. Let's first talk about independence.
Okay.
Because that is a critical issue that...
If you're related, you're generally not viewed as independent.
That's right. If you're related...
For-profit or non-profit.
If you're related by blood or by wallet, it's generally not independent.
So the financial relationship... So if it's an investor in your business or some relation, so a financial or truly personal relationship keeps you from being independent.
Right. And independence is really important, and it's becoming more so important these days as you hear more and more stories about organizations that create sweetheart deals to their executive
haven't
directors.
Haven't heard any of those in our newspapers.
We're all well-governed down here.
Yeah.
But if you don't have independent directors who can look at a transaction and say, look, this is in the best interest of the corporation as opposed to the best interest of this person with whom I'm related, your organization is at risk of making some bad decisions and you're at risk of violating your fiduciary obligations.
And define that fiduciary obligations. A lot of times that's a word that people hear but really don't fully understand what that means. Mm-hmm. What are our fiduciary roles as a board member?
As a board member, your primary fiduciary obligations are the duty of care, which means that you show up to your board meetings.
You read the stuff the board members get sent.
You are a breathing, sentient part of this organization participating in the way that you are expected to participate.
Well, and I like to pick on the one that's usually designated the treasurer of the board, because that person should really be qualified to be able to read the financial statements, to understand how a nonprofit is supposed to report and handle their financials, all of those kind of things. I see people put in that role that are good with numbers and have no clue and no experience in the truly financial realm of a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that's right. And this, I think, goes back to where we started this conversation in terms of building out a board. You definitely want to have the various skills that you're going to need for whatever your entity is. I mean, if you're not creating an immediately sophisticated financial organization, you might not need a CPA or a sort of investment specialist on your board. You might need sort of more programmatic people or more sort of organizational development folks. But, you know, at some point you're going to you know, you're going to hit a threshold where it's going to be very valuable to have that expertise on.
You just said two roles there, the organizational development. Let's talk about that. So having someone that's connected in the community that can generate other donors, visibility, image, those kind of things, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's one level of organizational development. I think when you are talking about developing a nonprofit, you know, you've got to look internally and externally. And that speaks to the external role. It is very, very important that boards of directors be both ambassadors and fundraisers in the community. So they need to be able to go out there and communicate the messages that you want to communicate in the manner in which you want them to communicate and build your brand and build your support, both in terms of goodwill, corporate goodwill and your organization's goodwill, but also in terms of bringing in financial dollars as well. Internally, it's a different set of expertise, but folks that understand how an organism works.
Right, how it grows, what systems you need, what processes, yeah. The proper care and feeding of the organization and its mission.
Exactly. And, you know, you might get lucky and get the one of the five people in the whole world that can wear both of those hats effectively. You know, you want to make sure you've got a mix of both of those skill sets on your board.
Well, and I think that's what we're kind of alluding to, that the board you start with is not the board that's going to be there in 5 years when you're raising $1 million in funds.
Exactly right.
So things change in that succession and that evolution of the organization. One of the things I frequently get asked as a question is, a founder comes in, they're the executive director, they put a board in place, and as the organization grows, the board takes over because they are representing that organization. And the founder is removed from the organization, no longer qualified to be executive director. How do the legal agreements, how do those bylaws and other things come into play in making that transition happen and so that it doesn't damage the nonprofit?
Yeah, that is always tricky. I mean, an entrepreneur is a special person, and they are, well, I don't want to overgeneralize, but oftentimes entrepreneurs are very good at certain aspects and for the start,
the concept, yeah. The passion that needs to get through that initial stage.
The visionaries, but oftentimes, though not categorically the case, once you sort of have established that vision, there needs to be the next stage of growth of the organization, sort of a person who can pick the ball up and institutionalize what was a vision and an idea that the founder created. And oftentimes there just needs to be a transition at that point.
Well, if it's done well, that founder can still stay involved in a board role, an ambassador role, but they're not the person that needs to lead that organization onto the next level.
Right. And, you know, some of that has to do with the governing documents, but at the end of the day, it's really about managing those relationships. I mean, it's really about, you know, having the right folks on the board who can help the executive director when the executive director is approaching that threshold, when there might need to be a transition, to think critically about where they want to be and where this organization is headed and whether there is a right match or whether it's time to sort of think about a transition plan.
And I think it's kind of a mindset thing. When we're a for-profit, someone owns the business, and the founder will usually still have some kind of ownership in it. A nonprofit is owned by no one. It's led by that fiduciary board with the day-to-day operations by that executive director. And I think that's frequently where people stumble and thinking, well, this is my nonprofit. I started this. This is exactly my mission.
Yep.
I'm passionate about it. How dare they say I'm no longer qualified to do it? I started this.
That's right.
And I think laying out in the operating agreement or the employment agreements, those documents, that there will come a point in time that a transition, a succession plan has to kick in. And I think people avoid that conversation early on in the organization and don't recognize the issues that can arise from that.
Right. It's hard to document that in an employment agreement because you just don't know.
There's got to be reviews. There's got to be performance. Those kind of things are in there so that if it's not matching up, whether it's, you know, I've seen documents that say, well, the executive director will always be employed here.
That's how not to do it.
Yes. But it's understanding that what can and cannot be there. There is no guarantee that if you start something as a nonprofit that you will continue to be with it for 100 years.
Right. Yeah, absolutely right. And, you know, you often see this in startup where it's the founder's dream to do this, and so they appoint themselves as board president, board chair, and also hire themselves as the
CEO, the CFO, the executive director, and everything else. Yes,
and then they have a board of you know, one or
the
two.
The chief bottleneck is how I typically refer to that.
Right, right. That's sort of the worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. There are organizations that can thrive in that way, but there are a whole host of risks in that.
One of which is what happens when that person's gone.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So we're talking about the founder. So let's talk about some of the dynamics and the mechanics of actually creating a legal entity. How do we create a nonprofit step by step? In big steps.
So if you've got an idea, and you have a mission statement in mind, to give this thing a birth certificate, you have to file articles of incorporation.
Are there different ones for nonprofits than for-profits, or are they just articles of incorporation?
They are variations of the same notion.
So I go to the Secretary of State's website.
There's a form that you can fill out, though I don't recommend that you necessarily fill out that form.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty sad.
You can also form a nonprofit via a trust as well. It's a rarer form of nonprofit, particularly for an operating nonprofit. Mm-hmm. It is a more common form of a nonprofit for, say, a family foundation,
okay,
where you've created a charitable trust that's going to give money away.
So we're going to go to the Secretary of State's office website. We're going to find out what nonprofit filings are there. Mm-hmm. We could look at some of the ones that are already filed.
You can.
They're actually there in PDF form.
Yep.
And get an idea as to what that process is, and we will go to a qualified attorney to advise us on the proper setup of it.
I would recommend that.
I would too, because if you don't set it up right from day one, you're going to have expense later.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's not hard. It's not rocket science to do articles of incorporation right, but there are some magic words that need to be in place for the next stage of the process, which we'll talk about in a sec, which is applying for tax-exempt status. But also in terms of, the most important thing about the articles of incorporation is your purpose statement.
Right.
What it is that you are formed to do, and generally speaking, what are the types of things that you might do to accomplish that purpose.
And looking at that, before we're going to define that purpose, we really need to go look at the 501c3 statutes for the state and for the IRS as to what is a 501c3 versus a C4 or a C6 or
right,
all those others, and make sure you're in the right spot.
Right, right. And so if you want to be a 501c3, which means that you are not only tax exempt, but you can also receive tax deductible contributions from the general public and from corporations, and also more easily receive grants from private foundations.
Now, we've set up that nonprofit corporation. We set it up. But if we don't go get 501c3 status, we're not tax exempt, correct?
That is correct. If you're a 501c3, that is correct.
Right.
If you so there are 29 types of 501c's, organizations that are tax exempt. To be tax exempt, most of those organizations just claim it and say, I'm described in 501c4, I'm described in 501c6, I'm tax exempt.
Name it and claim it. Okay.
Exactly. And I'm going to, file my Forms 990 and on an annual basis to inform the IRS that I exist and to, demonstrate that I do in fact meet the qualifications of that code. But when it comes to 501c3s, you actually have to apply for recognition of your 501c3 status.
Because you want that tax-exempt status recognized so that when someone gives you a donation, they can take it off on their taxes as a charitable contribution.
That's right. So when you go through the process, the IRS says yay or nay, hopefully it's yes, and then they add you to a list of organizations that are qualified to receive tax deductible contributions, and that's the list that donors can go to confirm
and
that they can make
that application. Is quite intimidating. I mean, it gets to be quite thick. there's financials, there's budgets, there's who's doing what, there's the mission, what you're not doing. I mean, you're going through this. I think one of them was a couple hundred pages when I did it with a client.
Oh, sure. Yes.
I mean, it's an investment of your time, and not doing it right means you're going to have to go back and do it again. Mm-hmm. And that slows down those charitable donations. Mm-hmm. So you want to get in, you want to spend time doing it correctly, get on a lawyer involved early and often, and make sure everything, we're hitting those words, we've got everything right with the state that we're incorporated in, so that it goes through the first time. I've seen nonprofit applications that have had to go back time and time again, and 1 year, 2 years, and 3 years have slipped away, and they've missed granting opportunities because they didn't have that status.
Yeah, and there are a number of footfalls that you can make in the application that can delay or cause you to get denied unnecessarily.
Give me a couple of those.
Well, gosh. You know, if you have already made arrangements to hire a family member, for instance, and
your board is all family members.
Exactly. You know, there can be some red flags, and insider deals and transactions are often the most highly scrutinized components of what you do. Of what the IRS will look at.
Because the IRS is concerned, as are the other regulatory entities, of making sure that this isn't a way of avoiding taxes to benefit the people that are in the nonprofit, that they're truly going to execute a mission.
Exactly, that they're organized exclusively for charitable purposes, which means that the flow of the resources and the benefit flows outward and not inward. So that's often a big issue. Sometimes I've seen situations where the activities of the organization were, you know, just not described accurately, or used words that the IRS are just sort of catchwords for the IRS that raises the IRS's suspicion that the activity is actually a commercial activity and not a charitable activity.
So meaning it's a because the description of the IRS says you're not to be doing commercial for-profit type activities under this. With a small caveat, but right.
Yeah, and there's a sort of mushy commerciality doctrine that if you quack like a duck and walk like a duck, you must be a duck. And so, a common sort of, these days we all like to use the term investment when we're talking about social investment and investing our time and investing in charitable organizations. And so, you know, there's simple things that how you phrase things can cause the IRS to, you know, do backflips. Because they might not be used to seeing that phrase the way you've used it.
Right, because certain things are defined a certain way in the IRS codes as to what those words mean or don't mean.
Right.
And they don't always keep up with common lingo.
Right.
So we're creating this. We've gone to Secretary of State. We've incorporated. We've done our 501c3 application. What else do we need to be aware of?
I guess in the interim, before you filed your 501c3 application, you have also adopted some bylaws.
Okay.
That would be, as we said, sort of your operating manual, sort of how I exist and make decisions on a daily basis. Depending on the state that you're in and the amount of money that you're going to raise, you will likely need to file for a charitable solicitation license.
Okay, and that's with the state?
That's with the state.
Or states?
Exactly.
If you're one for every state?
Multi-jurisdictions, you might be filing in 30, I think we're up to like 36 or 37 states that have these statutes on their books. If you're doing business in multiple states, you might need to register to do business in those other states. If you've got employees in Virginia and in North Carolina, you'll...
Okay, so you're actually starting to trigger... You're tax exempt, but that doesn't mean you're not going to collect sales tax if you're selling something. It doesn't mean
Correct.
You're not going to be paying payroll taxes.
Right.
It just means there's not an income tax
exactly
being
right.
remitted by your organization. So all the other taxable things that come into play will still occur.
That's right.
Some states may remit back to you your sales tax as a 501c3 up to certain levels, but you still have to collect it and remit it for your clients.
That's
you have
right.
to deal things with your vendors. And so there's those types of things that tax exempt doesn't mean you've wiped out all tax transactions.
Right, right. And not a whole lot of tax exempt organizations are selling goods that trigger sales tax, but more do than they realize.
Well, and I think of it like the Goodwill stores.
Right.
We're supposed to pay taxes. The other retail or consignment shops.
Right.
You're collecting. You're tax exempt. The person buying from you is not tax exempt.
Right.
So anything that you do that's in that mode. Some states, it's services. If you do a tutoring service and get paid for it, So it just kind of varies. You have to know based on what you're doing as to whether your clientele are going to have to pay taxes on that and whether you're going to have to set up to remit those in those those jurisdictions.
Right. And another level of that is property tax. If you own a building, you may need to apply for property tax exemption. That has been an interesting place where a lot of activity has occurred these days because local governments rely on property taxes. And
it's that property tax includes computers, real estate, office equipment. I mean, it's all those tangible assets that are there.
Yep.
And you have to really have that list. Again, it's your accounting. Mm-hmm. And you have to understand what they will exempt and what they won't exempt.
That's right. And you're seeing more and more states these days, or at least local governments, if not states, clawing back and saying, look, this organization, it might be a 501c3, but
you're using this for unrelated business income. That's a retail store, so it's property tax.
Exactly. It's taxable on the property. So there are some nuances there that, you know, usually you're only getting into if you're a sophisticated organization, but there are things to be aware of.
Believe it or not, we're almost out of time.
Wow.
So if you had two tips to give our listeners about not-for-profits, how they are going to choose who they're going to donate to, if they're thinking about starting up one, what do you want to leave them thinking about? I put him on the spot.
You did. I think in terms of thinking about giving, again, I think the nothing substitutes really getting involved with organizations in your local community, and your local community foundations are great ways to do that. We didn't talk a lot about giving vehicles, but it's also valuable for donors to look at the different ways in which they can express their philanthropy, because we talked about direct giving, but that's not the
time
only way. Yep.
Equipment.
Yep.
Other resources.
Or you can give via a donor-advised fund, or you can create a private foundation.
Sounds like I need to have Ed back again for another show. We could just keep talking about all of this. I want to thank you for being on the show. Let's give them your website.
www.schellbray.com.
And he is a local practicing attorney for not-for-profits. So I want to thank him again for being on there. And I want to remind everyone, this Thursday, November 6th, from 5 to 10 at the Hickory Tavern, come out and support this community radio station. We're underwritten by individuals and businesses in our area, and you keep us on the air. So Hickory Tavern, which is right here in the Hampton Inn at 370 East Main Street in Carrboro, from 5 to 10 this Thursday. And thanks again, Ed, for being on the show.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.